Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. 2 years ago today, Governor David Ige signed an emergency proclamation to address the problem of homelessness in Hawaii. At the time, the state's homeless population was estimated at 7,620 people. Hawaii continues to have the highest per capita ratio of homeless in the nation, with a population that continues to grow with no end in sight. The Honolulu City Council is looking at expanding its so-called sit-lie ban to all sidewalks on Oahu and to establishing safe zones, a policy that is already being implemented on Hawaii Island. We want to hear from you and on our phone lines at 941-3689 for Oahu and 1-877-941-3689 for neighbor islands are open. Joining me and News Director Bill Dorman are Lance Niimi, Executive Assistant to Hawaii County Mayor Harry Kim by phone from Hawaii Island, and in our studio, State Senator Willa Sparrow, who represents Eva Beach and Iroquois Point and chairs the Senate Housing Committee. Good morning, Senator. Good morning, Lance. Thanks for joining us. Lance is joining us by phone.
Good morning.
Lance, let me get a start off by having you describe what has been done on Hawaii Island with the safe zones.
Well, you know, we started our work with the homeless in Kona as a template, and the reason for that was we had an airport, Kona Airport, where our homeless had built up a large number of camps and people, and we estimated about 68 people in the Kona Airport, and people were asking us to restore the park. It's a park so that the people could be using it again for their families and take them to the beach like they used to and have walks in the morning and feel safe. So we did that piece to move the homeless people and we placed a lot of them in available shelter like they're doing in Honolulu right now. We placed about 17 families in a period of about a week. And then it still left us about maybe 35 more people that we were concerned about. So we placed a large portion of that 30 people in our camp and left about 15 people that we didn't address, but we placed a good portion of them in Camp Kikaha.
As it turns out, Senator Sparrow just visited Camp Kikaha yesterday.
Oh, he did? I didn't know. All right.
Yes, I was on the Big Island for a few reasons, and then we decided let's go visit the camp and look at some of the other affordable housing projects on the Big Island, and I'm happy to see that you have quite a few projects.
Yesterday. I missed you.
Next time.
Yeah.
And Senator, when you did go there, lessons for the Oahu side? Did you come back with some learnings?
Well, it was a little different than what I would have created or put up because, and Lance can attest to this, that I would like to see a safe zone where we actually have structures. Whether they be heavy-duty tents or these domes that the church has brought in or some type of low-cost structure that we can put these individuals in and allow them to put their belongings in, because it's great what they're doing on the Big Island, but from afar it does still look like a homeless area just on the corner. But I have to give credit to the mayor and his team for doing this as a pilot, and it's something that the city and county and the state have refused to do. I and many other legislators and even some councilmen in the past have tried to push this forward, and we have been unsuccessful. But with Mayor Kim's efforts now, I think it's certainly going to help us, as well as the significant problems we've had just in the last week when you look at Kakaako Park and the Keihi Highway Interchange and what a big mess that is.
About the only consensus we seem to arrive at is that it needs to be a combination of solutions.
Yes, yes.
No one seems to think that there's any one solution, right, Lance?
Yes, it's a huge challenge, and I realize that the numbers on Oahu are much, much larger than ours. So it is. It's going to require a multifaceted approach to dealing with issues.
We have a caller on the line, Frank from Diamond Head, with some suggestions about on locales and input about sitlai. Frank, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
I just had a couple of ideas I just wanted to throw out there. I've always thought that if folks don't have any other chance, they have to live in a tent, then what we should do as a society is find a place where they can legally erect their tent and then offer basic services to that area. You know, you could have places that were free initially that would have, like, they're more remote, but you're not going to get hassled and asked to move all the time. And you'd have, like, maybe bus service once a day into that area, or a place that might be a little bit better where you could have your tent. You know, you could have a little lot, and you could have more services and maybe a police presence, you know, at both if you had to, and maybe a, you know, twice a day bus service to that location. But just, you know, places with a little bit better services, but on the lowest end, where, like, you know, there's people that are going to be sleeping in their tents all the time. And if we had really strict rules where we, you know, we busted people for whatever, I mean, we had to somehow penalize these folks to get them to understand, like, look, you can camp, but you got to camp over in this camp area over here. And it's going to be safe. You know, there'll be a bathroom there. And then finally, I think there's an area that's already not being utilized, and that's called the old animal quarantine station. And every time I drive by it, it's all overgrown. Right? I'm sure there's some minimal, you know, stuff going on in some remote part of it.
Exactly. You're absolutely right.
Senator, you were nodding your head while Frank was saying that. I assume that dovetails with what you've been recommending.
No, definitely, 100%. I mean, that's the reasonable thing to do, and it's the compassionate thing to do. What we're doing now is just pushing the homeless from neighborhood, underpass to underpass, park to park, and we're wasting money, we're wasting resources. Kaka'ako Park might cost us $500,000 to repair. If there had been a safe zone, those individuals could have gone to that safe zone, and that $500,000 could have been put into helping and assisting and housing some of these individuals. The policy we have now is a failure. It is not working. And here we are 2 years since the declaration, and ask your neighbor, is it better? Are you happy with the progress? I think most of them are going to say, heck no.
Let's bring in a caller, Michelle from Kaneohe, talking about the sitlai ban and safe zones. Michelle, are you there?
Yeah. Hello.
Yes.
Okay. First off, I really like Willa Sparrow's ideas and the last caller, Frank's ideas. I agree with the idea of safe zones, like getting people out of the urban core. It's so disgusting that Kaka'ako Waterfront Park was the last straw for me. It's like the surfers can't go there. People, families can't go there. The other situation over on King Street where Stadium Park is, mm-hmm. That's another untenable situation. In Kaneohe, where I live, there's a green space behind Hei'ia Elementary School where it was either last year or about a year and a half ago, there were homeless campers up there, and somebody had a fire that started, I think they said it was a small propane tank. And where I live at Haiku Point Condos, we were seriously wondering if we were going to have to start moving vehicles. We had the fire department on our lot, you know, with this fire like 200 yards away that was just scaring people. What I would love to see is not only safe zones, but I would like to see some vagrancy laws with some teeth where the city and county coordinate with the state instead of the city and county and state constantly fighting with each other and pointing fingers at each other.
Let me bring in Lance from Hawaii Island about that last thing, vagrancy laws with some teeth. Are those helpful? Lance,
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Well,
The whole idea of vagrancy laws with some teeth, as the last caller, Michelle, just said.
I see, yeah.
Is that, you know, how effective are those? I mean, they're often described as criminalizing homelessness, right?
Yes.
Well, you know, there's issues of where there's some issues where they stay affect businesses and affect the rest of the community. It infringes upon the other people's rights, and I think the homeless people have rights, but so do the other people. So in some instances, we've had to ask people to leave certain areas where, like our park, that was one example. But we're still dealing with other issues of them staying at outside of our camp, and it affects the businesses in the area. So it's an issue that we try to deal with on a compassionate basis, but at the same time, some of the folks that occupy the areas refuse to leave. So the need for some teeth in legal situations, it would be helpful.
Bill Dorman, this is something we see a lot of, right? These people, the homeless people have rights, but we, the community, we, the neighbors, have rights too. Well, again and again, you get that collision, don't you?
You do, and you also, Senator, I was curious in terms of your thoughts on jurisdictional issues on a lot of these. This is another common thread that we see in terms of the broader homelessness discussion.
Yeah.
And I know from your experience on the public safety side of this as well, how do you look at that?
Well, in this case now, the county and the state need to do a better job of working together because they're not doing a good job. We have this effort with Scott Morishige, the Safe Zone Working Group, at the state level, and now the county's taking up a resolution or bill on this. I haven't seen either of them talking yet and working collaboratively because is it going to be a state park? Is it going to be a county park? Is it going to be state or county property? Let's choose one that we can have a consensus on. And my thought, I have several possibilities, one being Cahey Lagoon Park, and I believe that's a county park. I had this really elaborate possibility at Sand Island Park, which is a state park, mm-hmm. but because of some federal conditions on receiving it, it might be a little more complex, but that park is the most underutilized park in the Honolulu area. And my son, he's with the Next Step Shelter. He's in charge of it in Kakaako. We put together an actual budget. And if we only use 10-20% of that park on an annual basis, we might be able to accommodate 1,000 or 2,000 homeless. Using it as a temporary transitional housing center. And you have security, you have restrooms and showers, you have facilities for housing, and most importantly, heavy on the resources and services where you bring in the government agencies that are involved now, the nonprofits, the businesses, the unions, the churches, everybody. That is the perfect location because of its size, and you wouldn't be pushing out the park users because of its size. If anyone go there and drive on any given day or any other weekend, and you'll see how underutilized that park is, because this at the moment is about space. It's about where you can put somebody legally. Oh, and here's the catch or the clincher. The state has a campground on Sand Island where at full capacity 400 people can camp there. Now, what if the governor were to say, emergency proclamation, we're not going to have any more recreational camping at Sand Island. We're going to allow 400 homeless people to use that as a transitional housing center. You've got now 400 people in a place where there's recreational camping because of the crisis that we're in.
Caller Ron from Honolulu has something to say about the whole idea of if there is a camp, there should be decision-making policies in place. Ron, what kind of decision-making?
Well, I think if you're going to try to take care of the homeless, I think you should empower them with some decision-making so that they can empower themselves and get some kind of self-respect for themselves, that they're involved with their care of themselves. Like you could the people who are occupying the place should be part of the rulemaking policy and enforcement as well in keeping the place clean. They may be able to offset expenses if you employ them to keep the place clean, like the bathrooms, and enforcing the rules to make that a safe and healthy place. Also, you can maybe pay them for their participation in keeping the place clean and enforcing them. The other thing is the parks don't have a 24-hour enforcement like police force, and it would be better, instead of repairing all the damages that take place, to have like a 24-hour police force, even if you have to hire maybe a private security agency.
I want to bring in Lance Namey from Hawaii Island about with his views on that, but let me just real quick interject that we are asking listeners to call in. Number is 941-3689. On Neighbor Islands, you can call us, and we encourage you to do so at 1-877-941-3689. Lance, what's your response to what Ron was just saying about needing to have some empowerment of the people in a safe zone?
You know, I'm a social worker by experience, and I agree that the goal is as much as possible to have the people that live in our camp, which we're doing right now, to take more and more responsibility for cleaning and keeping the camp in shape. They've done a lot of that already. The other night I was there, they rained hard, and 2 o'clock in the morning, four of the campers were out sweeping out the water. You know, so that kind of responsibility taking. They plant and grow their own. They planted gardens outside just to make the place nicer. And I understand on Oahu there's a camp in Waianae that the similar things are happening. The other comment about security, when we did initially bring people over from the old airport, we had 24-hour, 7 days a week security. It's costly, but it was necessary. You got to have that process of having order and limits. And in place, and as that process takes place, we have a coordinator that's been working with the residents, and more of the responsibility given over to the residents as we move forward. We have right now we have the residents taking a larger part in all this happening. We're cutting back on the security costs because it is expensive, and so as we move forward, we try to adjust based on what the gentleman suggested, more responsibility taken by the people that are residents.
Lance, you referred to kind of imposing or creating order in a homeless, in a safe zone like this, and Will, earlier you used the term transitional housing, and how realistic is the whole idea of having a safe zone or any kind of encampment be in effect an actual transition, really making it all the way back into holding down a job, paying rent on a, you know, bricks and mortar place?
That is the goal. Yeah. That is the objective. And if we can't do that, then we don't do it. Mm-hmm. But we have to go into this that we will succeed, because what we're doing now, I won't say it's been a failure, but certainly from the public's perspective, when you see all of these individuals on the roads in the parks, people are shaking their head and saying, why is this happening 2 years from now, you know, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years? I mean, this has been an ongoing problem. Yeah. And the idea, of course, is to help these individuals. And we can't help them if they're roaming like nomads all over the island. Let's put them in one place where the resources are available and we could help them. That's just such a common sense comment. And yet we can't do that. And thus we have the problems. And I just think it just needs a little stronger, a little more assertive leadership from the county and the state to make it happen. We have the resources. We're spending tens of millions of dollars on these homeless individuals every year. And yet it seems like the progress we're taking are baby steps.
And Senator, the idea that some have said that if you do set up semi-permanent centers like that, safe zones, that that sort of discourages looking for work, being able to build a more sustainable life outside and beyond that stretch of homelessness.
But if you agree to be into a safe zone, you need to agree that you're going to improve your life and that the objective is to get you back up on your feet. We have to make it very clear this is not permanent, but this is government and others' effort to help you get off the streets. And if anyone thinks that you can stay here forever, then the safe zone is not for you, and we have to look at another method of helping that individual, whether that person is mentally ill, they're a drug addict, they're not taking their meds. Every person has a reason why they're on the streets, and we have to identify that reason and then find the best practices that fits that individual, because most of them are, the majority of them want to work, the majority of them want to live in a permanent house, and they just can't afford it, or they're underemployed. My son was telling me that at least two-thirds of them are underemployed, would love the opportunity to move into a house, but part of the problem is they can't afford it, and our inventory is low. I tell people we're not going to get out of this housing crisis for another 7 to 10 years. That's how much it's going to take. Our goal in government is 22,000 affordable units in the next 10 years. The only way to take care of that is to build, build, build. And in the meantime, we need to have these alternatives, and we need to expand those alternatives, and that's why we're talking about a safe zone.
I want to bring in a caller from the North Shore. Mark on the North Shore is bringing in a perspective.
Hi, thank you. I've been listening to this and sharing everyone's frustration. I moved to the island about 3 years ago from San Francisco Bay Area, where I proudly served on the United Way of the Bay Area Board of Directors and had been appointed by the mayor, who's now lieutenant governor, on a couple of different commissions to study homelessness. And my opinion is not politically correct, but Hawaii, we are 10 to 15 years behind in your thinking. I have not heard one single caller talk about the cause of homelessness. And what we learned in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I'll be very brief here, we divided the problem into three categories. Category one, identification of people who truly do not want to be homeless. Maybe they're working poor, et cetera. Pump resources into getting them off the streets and into housing. Category two, a truthful acknowledgement that some people you cannot save. And then category three, 75 to 80% of your resources need to go to cutting off the cancer. Stop trying to treat the cancer. How about identifying a cure? So in San Francisco, we did a comprehensive study, and we learned that the number one contributor, believe it or not, in the San Francisco Bay Area was the foster care system. Kids emancipated at age 18, had nowhere to go, they're kicked out on the streets. That was the number one feeder into homelessness in the Bay Area. So what do? We changed the whole foster care system so that kids have resources when they emancipate, and that greatly reduced the numbers going into homelessness. Anyway, that's my comments. I didn't hear anybody talk about pumping millions and millions of dollars into the cause, the root cause, and that's where the resources should go.
Sounds like a triage approach.
Well, I did briefly mention that many of our homeless are underemployed or don't work enough hours to afford, and that's a big cause of homelessness, and there's where we just need to build more affordable housing. But certainly we need to put more money into drug treatment and social services for the mentally ill. I'm working on legislation now that would hopefully basically have something like drug treatment on demand, because if we could get people off of drugs, obviously there's a plethora of problems that come with that, whether it's, you know, theft, burglary, crime, domestic violence, physical assaults, and get these individuals productive and working and contributing taxpayers. But certainly there are some that do not want to get the help, but the vast, vast majority of them do, and since we're lacking the units to house them today, what this primary discussion is about safe zones. Are safe zones something that we want to consider or not? And obviously, yes, with all of the resources that are available to us at these transitional centers, these safe zones, because what the gentleman just said, with the root of the problem, yes, let's fund those solutions. Let's find the individuals that can help and assist, and let's just do it, because it doesn't look like, from the public's perspective, that we're making the progress that we need to be making.
Senator, I'm just curious, in terms of the politics of homelessness, how have you seen the discussion shift or change? And I'm thinking even within the 2 years today since the governor's declaration of emergency.
Great question. Up until the 2 years when Kaka'ako became a ghetto, when it became a shanty town, mm-hmm. when it became something out of a third world country, frankly, we knew it was out there, but there wasn't a strong, concerted effort by anyone, in my opinion, to deal with it. Until we were embarrassed, not only here but around the world, the governor and the mayor then started working together. But sadly, we have so many other priorities and funding needs that homelessness is competing with, elderly care, child care, public schools, the environment, health care, everything that you can think of, universities. And I think what we need is just a strong leadership team that can solve this. And it is solvable. And we haven't had that focus like we're having now, although it is a little late, but at least we're now moving in the right direction, I hope.
All the solutions are pretty expensive, though, Senator.
Yes.
But as you said, there are many other demands on those funds.
But there are low-cost solutions as well. And the question is, do we have the political will and do we have the leadership to try these? And that's why we're having this conversation now on safe zones, because the state and the city and county had rejected safe zones for years.
Lance, on Hawaii Island, it's early to say, obviously, about your safe zone project, but what's your feeling looking forward about it?
Well, there's a couple of encouraging things that are happening. When people got placed in our shelter, safe zone shelter, there's been, I'll just quote what my coordinator said. She says, at Camp Kikau, we're able to provide a safe place where residents have little concern of being victimized in any way. And it in itself changes behavior and reduces incidence of aggression as a survival tool. So that's one thing. Just having a shelter where they're taken care of and given resources, it just could contribute tremendously to their well-being. The other kinds of things that have happened is the being in our temporary camp, a lot of them have agreed to move on to the services provided by Hope Services, for example, emergency shelter. So we have 8 people that moved on to Hope Services emergency shelter. And I think just having that experience working, living in our camp, it make them feel more comfortable to move on to the next level of housing. The other thing I know happened in Honolulu that happened with us also was when we were the sweeps that happened, a lot of people that wanted help moved into the existing shelter inventory. And I think that happened. I heard like 30 people moved, 60. I think I heard 60 this morning moved into existing housing in Honolulu after the sweeps. We had like about... we had about 17 out of the 62 that wanted help that moved into existing shelter. And the last thing is employment. We have like about 6 folks from our camp that have been employed since they moved in. So something happens that they get a little more comfortable. The people that get work inspire the others that are in camp. So they say, maybe I can get to work too, and they'll get into work. I think we got to do a little bit more on the employment side and create more opportunities, and we're looking at some possibilities for that. But the camp seems to provide an environment where certain more positive things can happen. And the last two things I'll mention, Linda, who's our camp coordinator and our practicum student that's working in with our team, they mentioned a couple of things. One is that health concerns are addressed much more quickly. We have a paramedic team that comes to our camp every week with our practicum student and the paramedics from our fire department. And they take care and address a lot of the health issues. There's staff infections that have been reduced significantly. There are other things like, I can't remember the name, but it's another infection that happens if you don't take care of it. It can get very much worse. The other issue is resolving court things that, you know, they get cited all the time and for different things. Our coordinator is working with our judge in Kona, where the people that are get cited are able to do some community service for a camp. You know, instead of just dismissing it, they're trying to work out so that the backlog of court cases gets handled much more quickly. And then, of course, there's a behavioral health issues and just having supportive people to work with them. They improve, you know, relationship improve. We have couples that have gotten better living together. It's always a challenge, but I think some of those things are happening in the camp that are positive.
Thank you, Lance. Lance is the executive assistant to Mayor Harry Kim on Hawaii Island, and I want to bring in another perspective from Hawaii Island. This is Richard from Mountain View. What's your take on all this?
Well, I'm just worried. I hear all of the individual interesting ways of trying to take care of homeless people, but I'm worried that Hawaii is such a small place that if we got really good at taking care of homeless, all the rest of the homeless in America would come here. So I think there's a disincentive to actually doing the things that we want to do. It's like an oxymoron. You can't do the right thing.
Well, I mean, I don't think anyone is looking at leaving the problem the way it is. What do you think, Senator?
I've heard that perspective, and honestly, I think we need to take care of people who are in need and have problems. And even across the continent on the mainland, I mean, there are places where they are attractive, you know, Miami, Los Angeles, San Diego, anywhere. We need to do what is best for the people who are living here. And although I understand the gentleman's concern, I don't think that there's homeless on the mainland, too many of them that are just waiting to come to Hawaii. I mean, everyone is unique. They have circumstances. And the vast, vast majority of the homeless do not want to be homeless, and they're not looking for a handout. They've come, you know, upon bad times, difficult times, circumstances in their life that have put them in that situation, and we as government, as a society, need to help them and try to get them out of that situation.
Bill,
Could I just add one real quick comment on
course.
That? The statistics that we got from our point in time, roughly around 50%, I say, of the people have been in Hawaii for 10 years or more, the homeless. And maybe 14% of them have been here less than a year. The other way we can deal with the issue of the concerns, it's a legitimate concern. We make it too comfortable what happens. But we also have a coordinated entry system that the state and the counties have been working on, where we house the most vulnerable, chronically homeless and most vulnerable people. So families get housed first, and they'll look at how long people have been homeless and other situations like where they're coming from. So the coordinated entry system will address some of the kinds of issues that people are concerned about. And then the other issue is that the statistics tell us that there are really not that many people just coming over here and contributing to the homeless. A lot of our homeless have been here for 10 years or more.
Lance, I want to pick up on something you said earlier, which is that helping people in a safe zone with their legal issues. And, Bill, this is something we hear mm-hmm. a lot of, the whole idea of criminalizing homelessness, that
right.
a lot of people, once they've been given a summons,
mm-hmm.
you know, they've got other problems besides finding a place to live and a job. Now they've got a fine, to meet, you know, court dates to get, all that. Right. So, in effect, I mean, the effect has often been described as kind of pushing them further down into the condition of homelessness, right?
Well, and also removal of the idea of hope. Hope is part of this discussion in terms of homeless not remaining homeless forever, that it's not fated in perpetuity, that there is a way up, a way out. And help with issues on the legal side as well is part of that broad picture, I think.
And actually, this last session, we did pass a bill. I don't recall the number. That allows the prosecutor to take these individuals with these citations and deal with them outside of the court system in community-based settings, especially where some of them may actually be residing and living, versus forcing them and having them come downtown and clog up our court system, because that is not what we want, and that was never the intention. You know, criminalizing homelessness is really just illogical, and that's something that we need to avoid as much as possible.
Jacob from Kapolei, do you want to weigh in on this? You said that you've been observing homelessness in downtown Honolulu.
Hi, yeah. So I was working in town on Iwale Street for a few years, which last year was really bad. So I got a pretty good sense of the condition or the state of homelessness in downtown Honolulu. And I just want to comment that, you know, we're talking about finding places to shelter and facilities, which is one thing. But the reason that that homeless people keep returning to metropolis areas is because that's where the food is for people with money and therefore food. So until you get to the, you know, until you can figure that one out, it's going to keep returning to that, where people come to, where the action is, to where the food is, and, you know, try to get what they need, because maybe they do or they don't want to be homeless, but they need to eat.
And anywhere that we do look at a safe zone, food and sustenance is going to be a high priority. And actually, it's not difficult to get food to the homeless anywhere on this island. My son was telling me that we have food pantries and soup kitchens and churches and people that are over-helping on the food area. And I think what's most important, why you see a lot of people downtown, is I think just because they feel safe here versus being in a rural setting or a country area. And probably just like all of us, we want to be where there's social activity, where there are individuals, and there's probably a better sense of safe and security for many of these individuals.
Lance and Amy on Hawaii Island, how close to you know, availability of food and resources is Camp Kikaha?
Well, one of the things our coordinator has been doing is getting the people that do want to help the homeless to bring food to our shelter. And I do agree that a lot of times where the food is provided is where a lot of the homeless will tend to be around, because they will have more instant access. So the safe zones would, if people that want to donate food, which is happening at ours, will bring actually take away. Say if they bring their food to us and not where they were serving it before, then, you know, it'll be more helpful for the people that they can get food in one place. We've gotten much more people volunteering to help us at our safe zone, Camp Kikaha, to bring food. And Hope Services also, we're on the same grounds as them. They provide food for the emergency shelter, which our residents are able to partake in on certain days that it's available for the community homeless.
Here's a caller from Kailua. Sean?
Yes, sir. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a couple of comments. Last night, a friend of mine flew in on her way on a vacation, and her boyfriend had a few too many beverages on the airplane. They got in a fight, and he took her phone and her access to her transportation, canceled her flight. So I'm just wondering if there's a portion of people coming here that have had some type of an altercation, or maybe had their belongings stolen and get caught kind of in a little downward spiral there. That's one thing. And also another thing I've noticed is that maybe there's quite a few Lake Nations coming for better services and health care and availability of resources here on Oahu. And, you know, due to what's going on over there and what the United States has provided them in the form of a benefits package, and how are we addressing that influx of you know, people coming over here to get the help and then really having no place to go?
I'm not sure where to begin responding to that, Sean. You know, you referred to immigrants from Micronesia who are here under the Compact for Free Association. In other words, that there is a stated obligation from the U.S. government to provide health care.
Is that the population you're talking about, or are you just thinking that maybe people from the mainland are coming here for health care? Because I don't think that's the case.
Well, a friend of mine is from Micronesia, and he was mentioning that his family had been provided some welfare services and some medical care, but they didn't have access to the facility over there and were actually provided resources to come to Hawaii in order to get the benefits here.
Right. Okay.
A lot of them are given stipends for vehicles and medical and welfare, but nothing particularly for housing.
I understand that. And yes, the Micronesian immigrants really did change the nature of our homeless, but you know, we basically bombed the heck out of their home decades ago and made it radioactive. And you know, part of the question is, what is our role now as the United States of America to these individuals? Unfortunately, many of them have come. They could go anywhere, actually, in the United States, but they have come here because it's very similar to where they came from, and they feel probably better than being in Santa Fe or San Diego. But we haven't had the resources from the federal government to deal with this influx of Micronesians, and that has been and continues to be a big part of the problem. We're attempting to do our best with trying to get more federal monies as well as state resources. But again, when you add that to a budget that you really didn't have a budget for, let's say 10 years ago, it does add some concerns and problems.
Senator, this is an issue, as you said, that has both a federal, state, and county component. And as predicted, we haven't solved it in the last 45 minutes, but hopefully we have raised some issues to get us all thinking about it. I want to thank Senator Willis Sparrow, Chair of the Senate Housing Committee, Lance Naimi, Executive Assistant to Hawaii County Mayor Harry Kim, and our News Director, Bill Dorman, and everyone who called in for taking part of that discussion. Lance Naimi is Executive Assistant to Hawaii County Mayor Harry Kim and a former social worker. He's been assigned by the mayor to address homelessness in Hawaii County. Senator Willis Sparrow represents Eva Beach and Iroquois Point in the Hawaii State Senate and chairs the Senate Housing Committee. And thanks to both you gentlemen.
Thank you.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Haleakala Waldorf School, announcing a high school open house at its Kalua Nui campus in Makawao, 10 a.m. to noon this Saturday. WaldorfMaui.org.
Honolulu police officer and a retired major are being arraigned today in federal court as part of a two-year investigation into alleged corruption in the Honolulu Police Department, an investigation that has already forced the resignation of Police Chief Louis K. Aloha. Do the arrests mean criminal indictments are pending? Civil Beat's Chad Blair has the story in today's Reality Check. Good morning, Chad.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
All right. The story is about a great deal more than the original mailbox issue, isn't it?
It is. Of course, that's where everything started back in 2013, the mailbox that was stolen. It's almost comical to say it, but it's led to very serious matters. In addition to the chief under investigation, his wife, a prosecutor, is involved. Her uncle involved as well, said he was framed. There was a dispute over money, but it has now moved into allegations of corruption and other serious matters. And one wonders, with the arrest of these two officers, one a former officer, as you said yesterday, will lead to, I mean, are we getting near the end? I think that's something we're all wondering. It is a moving story, though. The arraignment at 1:30 will probably reveal specifically what the charges are, and we'll learn more. But it does seem to be moving towards some sort of resolution.
All we know at this point is that they're being arraigned. We don't know until the actual arraignment after lunch today what specifically is being charged, right?
That's right. And our reporters, Nick Gruby and Louis Kinnea, will be there working on it, trying to find out. We will have an update, as you can imagine. Most media, including HBR, will be updating that story. The officers, Bobby Nguyen and Gordon Shiraishi, we do know that they are key figures in the grand jury investigation that's, you know, on KLOHA. So there's no question, or at least there's a very strong assumption that we will be learning more about developments. We can also tell you that they worked with a former HPD officer, Neil Silva. He's already pleaded guilty. And so there seems to be connections all around involving things. No warrant for arrest is out for the KLOHAs. And we'll see whether that changes as well.
But the former HPD officer, Neil Silva, has, as you said, he's made a deal.
Correct.
So he is testifying about, and he's pleaded guilty to conspiracy charges.
And go ahead, Chris.
Any details emerge from what he's, what do we know about what he has told prosecutors so far?
Well, some of that just hasn't been shared too much publicly, and hopefully will be coming forthcoming and sharing more information. Of course, if you can make a deal with someone, often they'll, if you will, spill the details, and that will lead to other indictments, and that's how these cases are often resolved. We do know the grand jury is set to expire this month, and even though it's unclear yet exactly what's going to come of it, as you said, it's much more than the mailbox. It's a wide-ranging criminal matter and way beyond what happened just 3 years ago.
And the officers who were arrested over the weekend were not entirely surprised, I imagine, because they had been notified by the Justice Department that they were under investigation.
The attorneys did not return our calls, but there are some news reports out there saying that it wasn't entirely unexpected. But we can just tell you from our reporting that certainly it had to come as a surprise in one regard or another. We do also know that there's possibly some ties to the city prosecutor's office being involved, and a concern whether corruption might be evident there. And that's where Catherine KLOHA works. Is this far more extensive than just Chief KLOHA and a few of his cronies? That's, I think, at the core of this.
It's a little bit of a frustrating stage for a story to be at when a great deal of the information is yet forthcoming. But we'll obviously want to keep track of it. Thanks very much, Chad.
Thanks, Chris.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring political and opinion editor Chad Blair.
Aloha.
I'm Dennis.
I'm Brittany.
I'm Danielle.
And I'm Sean. We're from the UH Manoa School of Communications.
You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported
Hawaii Public Radio.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet, also what we can look for in our dark island skies. As usual, we've got the expertise of Christopher Phillips to turn to, and we've got him on the line right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here.
So this week, stargazers, look out for Venus in the morning sky as it rises in the east around 5 a.m. Also, look out for Saturn in the westerly evening sky after sunset. This week, the moon will be passing through its new moon phase. This means perfect conditions for stargazing here in the islands.
And big news today, apparently, you've got.
It is, of course, the discovery of two colliding neutron stars that has given rise to powerful gravitational waves that have propagated across the universe and been detected by the LIGO Observatory here on the Earth.
So LIGO has detected gravitational waves before. Why is this one so important?
Well, this is the first time that optical telescopes have actually seen the source of the gravitational waves picked up by LIGO. Up until now, the sources of these waves have been somewhat of a mystery. The colliding neutron stars that produce these waves were actually observed by several telescopes around the world, including the Subaru Observatory atop Mauna Kea.
So, apart from actually observing the source, what's the importance for the future of astronomy?
Well, as our listeners will know, astronomy has mainly been conducted by observatories that study light from distant stars and galaxies.
I guess that's not how LIGO works.
Exactly. LIGO doesn't detect light from distant stars and galaxies, but instead studies ripples in space and time that we call gravitational waves. This latest discovery proves that this kind of astronomy not only works, but will open up an entirely new field of study, potentially revolutionizing how we perceive the universe in the years to come.
And we learned it from you right here, Christopher Phillips on Stargazer. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, designer of the Culinary Institute of the Pacific, committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design, providing research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point Live, this time in Boston, we talk the state of the nation with CNN's Van Jones, best-selling novelist Celeste Ng, and singer-songwriter Josh Ritter. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2, following the world.
And that concludes our Monday morning edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, the state's perspective from homelessness coordinator Scott Morishige. We like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow.